From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
What you're seeing is the importance throughout this period of these kind of segregated support systems. And he starts as a young lawyer, and then he gets what would be viewed as a promotion, being able to get a steady paycheck,
right?
At the Friends of the Court and doing that work inside the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's his Uncle Fred, the same farm down in Virginia that kind of helps him think through, what do you really want to do with your life? And is this why you went to law school? And is this what motivated you? And he takes a very big risk of giving up that sort of very steady job the Friend of the Court to really follow his dreams and be on this path, first to start, not at that period of time, but ultimately to found and run one of the most successful black-owned law firms in the country. And then, as they say, as his career evolves, the rest is history.
Peter J. Hammer, professor of law at Wayne State University Law School, director of the Damon J. Keefe Center for Civil Rights, and co-author of Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon J. Keefe, published by Wayne State University Press. In 1967, the Honorable Damon J. Keefe was appointed to the federal bench and has served as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 1977, where he has been an eloquent defender of civil and constitutional rights and a vigorous enforcer of civil rights law. The grandson of slave, Keefe rose from a janitor mocked for even considering becoming a lawyer to a legal giant who helped change some of the very laws and conditions that had locked African-American men like himself into menial labor. Yet, despite his own rise, or perhaps because of it, he holds in high esteem the men and women who sometime thanked his labor opened doors for him and others. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon J. Keefe with co-author Peter J. Hammer, In Black America.
Shortly after being on the bench, where he takes on sort of segregation in housing and,
right.
and what he was terming Negro removal in Hamtramck and declaring that to be unlawful, taking on school segregation and the very first northern school district in Pontiac, Michigan to be declared to have violated the Constitution with intentional discrimination and ordering remedies there, taking on private discrimination in Stamps versus Detroit Edison and ordering one of the largest damage awards in history and a very aggressive remedy to make sure that people who had been denied jobs get an opportunity to go and get jobs, taking on affirmative action in the police department in Baker and upholding the constitutionality of affirmative action when there had been a long history of intentional discrimination and vindicating Coleman Young's efforts to aggressively integrate the Detroit Police Department.
Right.
And then if you switch over from civil rights to civil liberties, you get perhaps his most famous case, which is even called the Keefe case.
Peter J. Hammer. For nearly 50 years, federal judge Damon J. Keefe has persuasively and movingly defended the Constitution, helping community and enforce their civil rights. He has spoken truth to power from the bench, prohibiting President Nixon and the federal government from engaging in warrantless wiretapping, and the Bush administration from conducting post-9/11 deportation hearings in secret. Judge Keefe's decision has desegregated public schools, broken color lines at corporations, and required municipalities to repair the damage caused by systematic racism. Born in Detroit, Michigan in 1922, he earned a BA degree in 1943 from West Virginia State College, his law degree in 1949 from Howard University Law School, and a Master's of Laws from Wayne State University Law School. Judge Keith has served as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 1977. Prior to joining the Court of Appeals, Judge Keefe served on the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan. He was appointed to that court in 1967 by President Lyndon B. Johnson. Also, he served on the Michigan Civil Rights Commission and as a member of the U.S. Army. In his book, Crusader for Justice, co-author Peter J. Hammer reveals how Judge Keefe's passion for justice informed his career.
The real honor of directing the Damon J. Keefe Center for Civil Rights, and one of our missions is really to make sure that people understand the wonderful life and legacy of Judge Keefe. So it was very important for the center that this biography be undertaken and that his story be shared to as wide of an audience as possible. And it's important that your readers know that this is written for a general audience. This is not a law text. This is a story about a human being that anybody from high school to senior citizenship status is going to love the narrative and going to love the story.
Damon was born on the 4th of July, which was odd in itself. Tell us about his early childhood.
Yeah, no, and he takes some pride in that because everybody knows that the promise of the Declaration of Independence that all men were created equal rang hollow when it was first made. And in many respects, his entire life and career has been built to making that a meaningful promise. But he grew up, like many people, to parents who came to Detroit through the Great Migration. His father came here older than most migrants at the age of 40 and was working for that mythical $5 wage in the Ford factories and the Ford foundries. And Damon grew up in northwest Detroit, went to a partially integrated, but only partially integrated, Northwestern high school. Went off to West Virginia State College, and in 3 months in the summer of 1943, had three amazing tragedies. One was the victory of actually graduating from college, and his father was able to see it. But within weeks of him coming home, his father passed away, who was the most important person in his life. And then the riots of 1943 interrupted, and then he was off to serve in a segregated army.
Why was it important for you all to begin the narrative with him studying for the law exam, working at the Detroit News building as a janitor?
Yeah, because it just reinforces the challenges that he faced. Here's a man who's a college graduate, served proudly his country in World War II, is a graduate of Howard Law School, which is really the West Point of civil rights. A white person coming back with those credentials would not be working as a janitor to study for the bar. And it just reinforces the tremendous obstacles that were in his way that he had to overcome, as well as making the story one that's accessible to everybody. You know, whether you're a famous jurist or not, everybody has suffered setbacks. And starting in that way was also a way to try to connect with readers from all sorts of backgrounds and really understanding what it means to deal with setback and frustration and systems that are unjust and unfair.
Tell us about some of the experiences that he had while he was attending high school.
Yeah, no, it was an interesting point in time in Detroit history. So it was allegedly an integrated high school. So there were
right.
black students and white students at Northwestern. But many of the activities were not integrated,
mm-hmm.
right? So he could run track, and he was a tremendous athlete, but he couldn't play football, right?
Right.
They could form some clubs, but they couldn't join others, right? They couldn't go to the prom. So you have all of this sort of a racial segregation built into it. And despite the fact that most people think that doesn't happen in the North, that was intrinsic in Detroit and many, many other northern cities.
Tell us about his other siblings.
Brother, yeah, no, big family.
His
father came up all by himself,
right.
Worked here to establish himself, sent back for his wife, Annie, and for their five children. And Damon was the only one who was born in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So and the only one that graduated from college. And that was critical to his father, that he said he doesn't want him to work in the factory like he did, wanted him to have a bright future, wanted him to go to college. In a very kind of touching scene very early on in the book and in Damon's life, his father was tremendously ill. And his father says he made a promise to God that if he could let him survive to see Damon graduate from college, that's all he wanted in his life. And that's what makes those events in 1943 just even so much more poignant and tragic, because God kept his promise. His father saw him graduate, but he didn't survive the summer.
Right. Judge Keefe attended West Virginia State University, and that was the first time he had ever been out of the city of Detroit. Lucky for him, his aunt was married to the president of the college.
Yeah, his cousin.
Cousin,
okay. And I keep making that mistake, and nobody's sharper than the judge, even today at 93 years young. And when we were doing through proofs, he found two instances where I said aunt and not cousin. So it was so it was his cousin. But what that shows you, and this is something I try to stress with students today that are in high school, Judge Keith succeeded because of a segregated power structure and the importance of extended family,
mm-hmm.
right? And nobody succeeds on their own. And sadly, I often say that the kids growing up in Detroit have a harder time than Judge Keith did because right. you don't have those same networks established. But, you know, he wanted to go to college. His father wanted to go to college, but they didn't have the money. And so that summer, after he graduated from Northwestern High School, his cousin Ethel is up here and is asking, Damon, what are you going to do next year? All right. You can imagine the kind of shame and disappointment and silence that fell with that question. But what she said is that you're going to West Virginia State College, and she made the arrangements. But he worked his way through
right.
college. And it's important to know that there's nothing demeaning about that opening episode mm-hmm. Of him being a janitor.
Right.
Right. And in fact, he worked as a janitor. He worked as a chauffeur at West Virginia State College, and he was proud to do that. You know, nobody works harder. And he had the privilege of driving the president around with all sorts of luminaries coming through. So he was able to meet people like Adam Clayton Powell and other tremendous luminaries at the time and kind of be that fly in the wall, the man driving the car and just listening to those amazing conversations going on in the back seat.
While attending West Virginia State College, I assume that helped shape his future with him considering becoming a lawyer.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, the turn towards law came later.
Okay.
It certainly opened his eyes.
Right.
And this was the first time that he saw African Americans in positions of authority.
Mm-hmm.
He never had a black teacher, and he went to go to a historical black college, and then met some of the best and the brightest that our country had to offer. But it was only after coming back from World War II. And there's another wonderful vignette where he just his officer's asking him to reenlist, and there's no way he's going to reenlist in that segregated army. He's going to fight for his country in different ways. But he was on the fence between being a social worker and being a lawyer.
Right.
And it was one of his friends who said, I'm going to law school. And he said, Damon, you should go to law school. And it was his belief that law offered a better opportunity for social change that led him to Howard Law School and not to a career in social work.
His cousin was also influential in getting him in Howard.
Yeah. No, I just say that you got to have Rick. And the president of West Virginia State College, young man coming back from the war is not necessarily thinking about his future within months, but if you've got to meet a deadline, sometimes you got to act within weeks and hours. And so it was both President Davies that made very clear that if he was going to go to law school, he should go to Howard, and then provided kind of the assistance and guidance to make sure that that became a reality.
While attending Howard, he met the late, great Thurgood Marshall, but other lawyers at the university. How did that help shape his ideals?
Yeah. Can you imagine what it's like to be a law student and to be able to learn under Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston
right.
and that legacy? And he was able to go see the moot court arguments, right? So
mm-hmm.
one of the famous cases was Shelley v. Kramer, which was challenging restrictive covenants in housing. And there was a companion case from Detroit, Sipes versus McGee. So in a case like that, Damon's able to go there and hear the oral argument at Howard Law School, and is then able to go follow that team of outstanding lawyers and sit in the Supreme Court building and hear the actual arguments. And if that doesn't inspire you for social change, I don't know what would.
Oh, no, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Peter J. Hammer, Director of the Damon J. Keefe Center for Civil Rights and Professor of Law at Wayne State University School of Law, and co-author of Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon Keefe. Once Judge Keefe finished law school, he had to study for the bar, but he also had to find a job to support himself. And I'm going to get to, when he finally had a date to meet his wife, but having those two things on his plate at the same time.
Yeah, and coming back to Detroit in the late 1940s as an African American, your options
choices.
Are pretty limited.
Right, choices
yeah.
were not plentiful.
No, and as the book details, that these great lawyers, many of them have to have second jobs to pay the bills. And they have to sit around at the recorder's court and hope that a white judge is going to throw a case their way. for indigent representation. So it was very tough starting out as a lawyer. And Judge Keith did what many others. You did what you had to do to put food on the table, pay the bills, and then diligently prepare the pathway for a professional career.
Now, when he eventually met his wife, Rachel, Judge Keith was not a macaroni, as we would say back in the day. And and one of his partners said, "Don't mess this up."
Yeah, no, there's some great levity in the book, but what people should also understand is despite the fact this is a story about civil rights and social change, all throughout the book it's a real love story, a real meaningful love story about two very special people, and people need to know that Rachel Boone Keith was an all-star in her own right.
Right.
She was a stellar medical student, just sort of blowing away the standardized tests and her teachers and her classes, an amazingly accomplished woman. I still go around town today, and people will tell me about Judge Keith's wife and her being their doctor and how special that was. But the nature of that relationship is really inspiring for anybody who wants to see what real romance through an entire sort of 53-year time together can look like.
Now, when they went south for the wedding, Damon was somewhat perplexed when they got to the estate in which her uncle lived, and said an African-American could not be living here. They must be workers.
Yeah. So you understand the humor, and your listeners will too. First, he's going down and thinking, "I'm going to get married on a farm." He's
right.
A city boy, right? Yeah. I thought you're going to go down to a farm in Virginia to get married. Has its own kind of irony and humor. And when he gets there, he's, you know, they're all diligently following the directions, trying to find the right place. And nobody wants to get lost in a country road in the South. You want to be very careful who you ask for help. And they go up and ask this, you know, African-American gentleman, says, you know, this is, yeah, it's a great place here. He says, but where's this address? And he says, well, you're here, right?
Right.
And go through that whole sort of revelation that Uncle Fred really has a fine estate down there. And that stayed in the family, sort of these nice things. And mm-hmm. he still tries as best he can to celebrate his birthday down at that same farm every year.
When Judge Keith passed the bar, he did like every other young lawyer. He had to find work, and he went to work, fortunately, for an African-American law firm.
Yeah, and again, what you're seeing is the importance throughout this period of these kind of segregated support systems. And he starts as a young lawyer, and then he gets what would be viewed as a promotion, being able to get a steady paycheck,
right
at the Friends of the Court and doing that work inside the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's his Uncle Fred, the same farm down in Virginia that kind of helps him think through, what do you really want to do with your life? And is this why you went to law school? And is this what motivated you? And he takes a very big risk of giving up that sort of very steady job the Friend of the Court to really follow his dreams and be on this path, first to start, not at that period of time, but ultimately to found and run one of the most successful black-owned law firms in the country. And then, as they say, as his career evolves, the rest is history.
Now, when he started with the African-American law firm, at some point he wanted to, I guess, see if he could cut it.
Yeah.
And he started his own firm, and then he moved into a new building where there weren't any African-Americans in that building. And he said, well, if I move, how will people find me?
Yeah. No, he's path-breaking at every stage.
Okay.
And ambitious, mm-hmm. And successful. So at some point he gets tired of working for others.
Right.
He decides he's going to start his own law firm. And he not only starts his own law firm, he breaks the tradition of going across Woodward into the Guardian Building. And the very first African-American law firm to do that. And there is concern, right? Are your clients going to follow you, right? They're going to the same building, to the same group, to the same part of town all the time. And, you know, the short answer is they not only followed him, he was able to get an amazing group of law partners, and in relatively short order was able to establish this amazingly successful law firm.
Right. When did Judge Keith receive his first judgeship?
That was not until 1967,
okay.
Right? But there was an important earlier episode where in 1963-64, he was named to co-chair the Michigan Civil Rights Commission,
right.
Which
okay.
had been newly enacted and adopted in the 63 Constitution. and he's had a life of public service that goes back to his life as a lawyer, helping rebuild the NAACP chapter in Detroit in the 1950s with his good friend Arthur Johnson, serving in the Detroit Housing Commission in the 1950s in that capacity, who was part of the team that helped Rosa Parks when she had to come to Detroit and flee Montgomery to actually find housing. So this notion of public service goes all the way up to his judgeship, but that didn't happen until 1967.
It was interesting what you all put in the book, how instrumental he was that the legacy of the Detroit NAACP Freedom Dinner.
Yeah, no, I just not quite of the biography, didn't make it in, but you know, we do a lot of events here at the Key Center.
Okay.
And he just as meticulous as an event planner,
right?
And he used to drive me crazy, you know, where's the invitation, what does it look like, what's the paper going to be on? But in the process of doing the biography, when I learned that he was the one that helped create this Freedom Fund dinner, which is huge,
I mean,
just a huge, massive undertaking, that the light bulb went off. You know, he's not only an amazing jurist, not only an amazing human being, but he is an event planner par excellence. But more than an event, that turned the chapter around, and that raised the profile and really reinvigorated the Detroit NAACP chapter, and he just has so many different range of skills.
Besides his judicial renderings, he was a great humanitarian. You mentioned Rosa Parks, and Rosa Parks' house got broken into, and she was apprehensive in returning to that particular home, and Judge Key found her another place to live.
Yeah. No, I mean, as I just say, what's amazing is that relationship goes back to the 1950s, and housing is central.
Right.
So when Mother Parks was getting older and Detroit is changing, and she's being assaulted inside of her own home, you know, the judges say, you know, Mother Parks, you're not going back there, right? It's not safe. And then again, as part of this team that puts together an effort to find her a safe place to live for the rest of her life. And they did that.
Tell us about some of the historic renderings that Judge Keefe rendered during his illustrious career thus far.
Yeah, you can think about civil rights, you can think about civil liberties.
Right.
And it's like this amazing grand slam in the early 1970s, shortly after being on the bench, where he takes on sort of segregation in housing and what he was terming Negro removal in Hamtramck, and declaring that to be unlawful, taking on school segregation and the very first northern school district in Pontiac, Michigan to be declared to have violated the Constitution with intentional discrimination and ordering remedies there, taking on private discrimination in Stamps versus Detroit Edison and ordering one of the largest damage awards in history and a very aggressive remedy to make sure that people who had been denied jobs get an opportunity to go and get jobs, taking on affirmative action in the police department in Baker and upholding the constitutionality of affirmative action when there had been a long history of intentional discrimination and vindicating Coleman Young's efforts to aggressively integrate the Detroit Police Department.
Right.
And then if you switch over from civil rights to civil liberties, you get perhaps his most famous case, which is even called the Keith case, where he declared that President Nixon, at the height of his political power, this was long before Watergate, could not illegally wiretap people in this country, that even the president was not above the law, and that the president had to get a judicial warrant if the Justice Department or the FBI wanted to engage in wiretapping. And then if you fast forward to George W. Bush at the height of his power in the wake of 9/11, Judge Keith was on the panel that declared that you couldn't have secret deportation hearings under a blanket national security. And there's a wonderful phrase that's emblazoned in the Key Center here coming out of that opinion, saying that democracies die behind closed doors. And that has caught wildfire. And you can find people in Kenya and Indonesia and all throughout the world that are declaring that democracies die behind closed door, and the judge opened up those doors.
Now, throughout Judge Keith's career as a jurist, not everybody was in lockstep with him, considering that some thought they should have received some of the judgeships that he received.
Yeah. No, one thing that doesn't change is politics. There's politics in all judicial appointments, although the flavor of the politics really has changed. I think that's part of the story, that Judge Keith was part of that judicial generation that was called upon to interpret the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s and legitimately but very aggressively interpret them to reach their intent, which is actually do justice. And sadly, in the last 30, 35 years, a different kind of politics has come into judicial appointments and sort of litmus tests of conservatism and strict construction. So Judge Keith, who wrote those cases in the 1970s and really did landmark changes, has had to also sit and watch the law sort of recede and really become eviscerated in many respects and go from writing majorities to writing some very important dissents in civil rights cases.
Now, one thing I noticed and was interesting was, I call it strange bedfellows. Judge Keith and his relationship with Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
Yeah. No, and it is strange bedfellows, and the stories in there, and this is a long-term relationship.
Exactly.
You know about the judge. You know,
20 years in counting.
And long before Justice Thomas was Justice Thomas.
Right.
And it goes consistent with Judge Keith in his sort of tradition of mentoring, and the quality of mentoring, and he established a mentoring relationship with Clarence Thomas back when he was a part of the EEOC,
right.
And that relationship continues to this day, even though in terms of their values and jurisprudence and civil rights beliefs is the difference between night and day. So it's a very complicated and you know, interesting story about their relationship.
And I also found it interesting, and I'm glad you included in the book, that Clarence Thomas, irregardless of his judicial rulings, was very instrumental in getting African-American judges on the bench.
Yeah, no, and I say there's complications everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And to his credit, at some very key points, Justice Thomas has not been ideological, but really has been consistent with this belief that people should be judged on their merits, and has helped clear the way to get hearings, which
right.
is, you know, essential, but sometimes very hard to do, for confirmation for some very important African-American judges in Michigan.
Now, when Judge Keith was placed on the Sixth Circuit, he didn't mince words on some of the rulings that his colleagues set out.
Yeah, no, he has tremendous courage, but tremendous frankness.
Right.
And he will tell you what he thinks, and he will stand up to people. And one of the themes in the book, and something the judge says, and is that day doesn't go by when he's not reminded in some way, great or small, that he's an African-American. And there is serious prejudice in all parts of society, including those that are wearing black robes. And he's been fighting against that as part of his career as well.
Peter J. Hammer, professor of law at Wayne State University Law School, director of the Damon J. Keefe Center for Civil Rights, and co-author of Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon J. Keefe. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.